Do I miss them? That's not the word I would use. I know they've been gone for a long time, but it's hard to miss someone if they keep calling you every 5 minutes to ask questions. I sent them to some of the best in the business to learn, but the only person they'll listen to is me. No, they're both too stubborn for their own good, and Cassidy is ready to dump them back here with me before the heat's died down. They were in Hong Kong, saying hi to some old chums of mine. No, they fought some devil rats, and they had some fun in the Astral Shallow. Now they're flying off to Asamanu. Look, I know what I'm doing. Calm down. It'll be fine. I hope. Coming to you straight from the most reliably biased source of the Matrix, this is the Anarchy in Podcasting Network, and I am Opti. Welcome to the Neo-Anarchist Podcast. I'm back to give you nothing but the most essential information of the year 2061, and crows, there is a lot to give. 2061 is known as the Year of the Comet, because Halley's Comet swung low, and the resulting chaos was chaotic. There's so much strangeness this year, it's hard to categorize it, but I've tried. Regardless, there's a lot of what transpired that is interconnected, so I will try to bridge some of those gaps when and if is necessary. First, a story that gave 2061 the name that it has. On January 1st, the UN commemorates the arrival of Halley's Comet by declaring 2061 the Year of the Comet. Most megacorporations make some plans to send up probes to gather data from the comet itself. On September 5th, people could see Halley's Comet with their naked eyes. And on that same day, the world loses its mind. Not the people of the world, the world itself. All over the globe, banner storms begin raging. In Hong Kong, an astral shallow develops about 1 kilometer around the Wuxing Sky Tower, allowing astral space and mundane space to coexist, visible even to non-awakened metahumans. And of course, the rift at the site of Dunkelzahn's death begins to pulse with magical energy. Not even one day later, a phenomenon known as surge, or sudden recessive genetic expression, begins happening. Surge causes vast changes in many metahumans, much like the UGE and goblinization events did so many years ago. Over 1,000 cases soon are reported, and new species appear, along with radical physical changes happening to individual metahumans, and the world responds with a new wave of hatred and racism globally against these so-called changelings. By September 10th, surge is confirmed to be a global phenomenon, and a few days later, riots begin happening in nearly every worldwide sprawl. On September 15th, one of the good ones, a non-violent orc rights activist named Rohit Talwar, is murdered while he tries to defend a changeling from a racist gang. This kind of occurrence leads the governor of Seattle to declare a state of emergency as the violence gets too heavy for him. 2 months later, the November issue of the Neo Scientist shows how surge is happening to other species outside of metahumanity. Our next dive is into the pool of geopolitics. January finds the continuing saga of the dragon's toenail clippings unresolved as Justin Rockefort, the voice of the Ogun, makes his way to Washington to collect his due as a result of Dunkelzahn's will. He's assassinated on the way, and Marcus Cross becomes the temporary voice of the Ogun. This next bit comes from the Algonquian Manitou Council. In February, outside the Aztechnology headquarters in Calgary, a car bomb explodes and kills over 2,000 people, including Bobby Bear, the civil chief, and Carl Hilborn, the war chief. The Azzies blame these elven eco-terrorists, and Adam Dockstader, the new war chief, begins to crack down on eco-activists. The tribe called the Manitou, made up exclusively of elves, also suffers under increased scrutiny. Later in 2061, Algonquian and Aztechnology military assault a boathouse on the Hudson Bay, thought to be harboring terrorists. Everyone inside is killed, earning it the name the Hudson Bay Incident, and it sets off a firestorm when some of the dead turn out to be Manitou tribe leaders, as well as 5 anti-Aztechnology terrorists. The tensions continue into December, when the remaining Manitou leaders gather at the Lynn Lake Great Lodge and call an emergency policy meeting. On the third day of the meeting, media are shut out, and only elves are allowed to stay. The elven Manitou leaders continue to meet in secret, but the ramifications of the meeting are not felt until the next year. In April, things start rumbling in the California Free State. Japan still held control over California, and General Saito, who was in control, starts bringing his racism to the West Coast when he outlawed orcs from learning Orzhet in the Free State. Later that year in October, the Ring of Fire erupts across the Pacific Rim, and earthquakes and volcanoes cause untold damage in Japan and the Philippines. Hundreds of thousands die, but Japanese leadership is thrown into chaos as the emperor and most of his family are killed as well. Japan declares a state of emergency and calls all Imperial Marines to return home from abroad to help with the recovery efforts. Unfortunately for many involved, General Saito was too busy enjoying his power trip in California, and he refused to withdraw. He pulled a military coup in San Francisco and was supported by his loyal troops and various Japanese megacorporations. He and his former Japanese Imperial Marines occupy San Francisco, and he declares himself to be the new Protectorate General of California Free State. A bit further south, a massive earthquake strikes Los Angeles and destroys the containment walls that held the El Infierno slums. Those inside explode out and start riots in the city. Everything starts burning, and Pueblo Corporate Council military enters Los Angeles to restore peace. They do restore peace, and along the way, they claim Southern California for the Pueblo Corporate Council. Across the world, on July 21st, the Black Forest Troll Kingdom's ruler, King Berthold I, vanishes without a trace. No manner of investigation turns up any evidence of foul play, and temporary regent is appointed in Chancellor Hugo von Haslach. Now, here's why you come to me, kiddies, and not some corpro national history book. Back in 2012, the Great Dragon Ferschwinga became the first great dragon to be taken down by humans in the Sixth World. She had gone kind of crazy and was killing lots of people, so the German military threw everything they had at her. She crashed into the Sock Zone, which was already well irradiated by then, at which point the great dragon Kaltenstein, who was, at least according to one of my sources, Ferschwinga's mate, went berserk and tried to rescue her. At which point he was confronted first by the dragon Nebelair, and then by the great dragon Lothair as well, and they prevented him from helping. It seems that for Nebelair, this was an act of loyalty and possibly affection for Kaltenstein, not wanting him to be affected by the radiation. For Lothair, this is a calculated move. On one hand, he gained the loyalty of Nebelair, and on the other, he prevented the world from joining together in a war on dragonkind so soon after the Awakening. Regardless of motivation, the result of the confrontation was that Kaltenstein crashed into the German Black Forest. Now, here's where things get interesting. More interesting than four dragons fighting and crashing? Yep. Now, I have conflicting reports about this, but the bottom line remains the same. In 2038, 26 years after his crash, Kaltenstein begins taking the form of a wizened troll mage who was always seen with a cane and a limp. This troll supported, manipulated, or both, another troll named Berthold. And together, they went from one German troll internment camp to another, freeing the captives and forming a resistance army and eventually winning independence, establishing the Black Forest Troll Kingdom. Berthold became the first and only king. Now, it should be noted that some have even suggested that Kaltenstein was Berthold. But if you know what to look for, the evidence just doesn't add up. Of course, the general populace knows nothing of Kaltenstein's involvement, mind you, but even the best ideas don't go as planned. There was a lot of resistance to the Troll Kingdom from the surrounding countries, and given the low economic growth and poverty, it led many to call for democracy in the Troll Kingdom. Of course, if they knew a dragon was behind it, they might have been less willing to speak out. So here's why I think Bertie disappeared. Kaltenstein either decided that he was done playing ruler, or perhaps his rage died down a bit, or maybe he realized that his revenge wasn't likely to happen through the Troll Kingdom, or maybe, just maybe, he decided that the trolls he rescued and fought and died for him deserved a chance to decide their own fate. Yeah, I think that last one is a bit too far out there, too. Still, Kaltenstein's puppet Berthold vanished and was never found, by the way, and just when the tension in the Troll Kingdom was peaking. Coincidentally, I'm sure, German authorities soon found Kaltenstein's hoard in Feldberg and later that year. If it was an act of dragon kindness, take note. It doesn't happen often. 2061 also saw some interesting developments in the Middle East. The leader of the Islamic Unity movement, Badr al-Din ibn Isa, is assassinated. The assassination took place in front of the Kaaba in Mecca in the Arabian Caliphate. He was placed in a mausoleum, but 5 days later he gets up and walks out and proceeds to declare what he calls the new Islamic Jihad. A few days later, unrelated to that, no really, a German anti-foreigner, anti-metahuman terrorist group called National Action, led by a guy named Matthias Hess, releases a new strain of VITAS that is airborne into the Olympia Park Stadium in Munich, Germany. Metahuman homeless and aid workers are killed by the thousands. In corporate news, March sees the corporate court founding what is known as the Grid Overwatch Division. Grid Overwatch Division, or GOD. Bringing together IT professionals, spiders, and hackers from all over the globe, it is tasked with enforcing Matrix law across every and all jurisdictions. Now, I have been doing some digging into GOD lately. I know, not good for my health. At any rate, I hired Shifty to infiltrate God's New York server bank. He spent months just schmoozing his way into one of its good graces, and eventually he kidnapped this guy and handed him over to Mr. Pink for questioning. This was a guy who should have known all about God, but at the end of the day, he knew nothing. I repeated this experiment a number of times. Shifty did his spy thing, Pink did the interrogation, same result each time, which leads me to believe that there might not be anyone on the planet who has a full grasp of everything the Grid Overwatch Division is capable of. Now, these next bits might seem odd, and they are, but everything considered, they aren't as odd as everything else that happens in this year full of odd things. First, Ares accidentally destroys a Sauterkraut space probe. Of course, Damian Knight apologizes, but the Duccio probe is no more. Then, a Shibata probe called Kepler is hijacked just before launch at As Technology's Spindle Space Station. Then, Shiwase Corporation's Brahe probe explodes due to the terrorist called the Cataclysm, killing everybody on board. Then, just before contact with the comet, Yamatetsu's Gagarin probe drops off communication. Then, a meteor hits Ares' own Gigas probe, knocking it off course and rendering it useless. Needless to say, all attempts to probe Halley's Comet end in failure. Coincidence, I'm sure. Probably due to all the failures of the probes, Novatek decides that instead of a probe, it's just going to start construction on their Olympia lunar base. Now, one bit of news from this year is encouraging. The shutdown of the Renraku Arcology ends in 2061. After attempting to heal his mind following the confrontation with the AI Deus, Tibetan monks give Anazo and Neki back to Renraku. Some Shadowrunners nabbed Neki and brought him to the Arcology to try to delete Deus. A lot of runners were involved in one way or the other with a shutdown. In fact, a chummer of mine, fellow fixer named Talleyrand, made some rather bad calls by sending runners into various situations involving the Arcology, and it almost ruined his career. He was one of the top 5 or 6 fixers in Seattle, if I remember, and I did some jobs for him back in the day as well. Yeah, he had a great eye for talent. He once gave me a job doing magical security for... well, never mind that. Anyway, we had similar taste in music, probably because he's British, but he was also known for treating his runners really well. But he hit hard times after 61. Oh, he's alright now. He's just building his stable back up and his rep is recovering, but his story is fairly typical for people running the shadows in Seattle during those years. Back on topic. In May, Renraku enlisted the help of another AI named Magiera to help destroy Deus. Along with Aneki, it worked, and Deus was defeated. Sort of. Deus actually escaped the Arcology by uploading himself into the minds of 1,000 people. We'll talk about that another time. Later on in the month, Renraku let the world know that the shutdown was over, but the cleanup was ongoing for a while as Deus' drones were still hanging around. In June, Renraku announced the passing of their CEO, Anazo Aneki. In August, the two AIs, Magiera and Deus, start battling each other for control of what was called the Network. That was the 1,000 people that Deus used to escape the Arcology. Now, here's some magic mayhem that went on in 2061. Seems that for whatever reason, Halley's Comet affected the ambient mana around the world. The result is that the world reacts for a short time as if the mana were at a much higher stage than it actually was. For example, at the summer solstice, Stonehenge decided to rebuild itself like it was created yesterday, and then it proceeds to fuel the mana line underneath it. In August, a group called the Aleph Society starts claiming that it can restore magic to burned out mages. Further, their leader, Dr. Michael Nixon, says that their ultimate vision is to help every individual realize their latent magical potential. On September 15th, Dunkelzahn's Rift starts to shift again, and witnesses claim that 3 spirits fly out. In India, a week later, an astral flood happens at the Ganges River, and hundreds of sadhus become changelings. Many surge with golden or blue skin, or with monkey or elephant features. In October, the Humanist Poly Club starts a riot at Dunkelzahn's Rift. Security is called in and brings spirits with them, but the spirits just float around and refuse to help. The spirits keep flying around until the cops eventually do the job on their own. The next day, a bunch more spirits fly out of the rift, and 11 civilians are killed in the riot caused by the spirits rushing into the crowd. Halloween brings even more spirits buzzing around the rift, and right after midnight, a Wu Zhen tells rift security that one of his ancestor spirits is telling him that the dead are returning. That sounds ominous. On November 10th, a group of volcanoes in France erupt. But not on the material plane, on the astral. 13 awakened people are killed, but no one else seems to notice the astral magma. On November 27th, the Dunkelzahn Institute of Magical Research reports that they have discovered naturally occurring auric alkum. Of course, this sets off an auric alkum rush among the Megas and changes everything we knew about alloys and geology. Dunkelzahn's island and the Eifel Mountains seem to have the biggest natural occurrences of auric alkum ore. On December 17th, some more spirits fly out of the Borobudur Temple in Java. The Astral Space Preservation Society work with the Javanese to capture and identify them. Now, make sure to scan this, Crows, because this is important. On Christmas Eve, a gigantic astral form, looking like a dragon, rips out of Dunkelzahn's rift. It flies away towards the west. Following on its heels are a bunch of new spirits that were pulled through the rift with it. These spirits are particularly nasty and become known as Shadim. They have the power to possess people. The next day on Christmas, the Department of Health and Metahuman Services in the UCAS shows proof that these Shadim do and in fact have possessed the bodies of dead metahumans. The draconic astral form regains its physical body on Christmas, and it is that of a great dragon, which proceeds to rampage through Denver, destroying the Azatlan Teocalli, and spends the next few weeks busting up the Azatlan sector of Denver. It has only a minor scuffle with Cass military, and then it backs off. A few days later, the great dragon is called Ghostwalker by the news. Ghostwalker once again flies through Denver and kills 6 people, including a racist polyclub leader. The dragon then goes on to crush a bunch more buildings, mostly belonging to the Azzies. In the Year of the Comet, the crazies seem to be out in full force, and I counted no less than 5 cults that were formed or gained prominence during 61. First up is the Children of the Dragon group. This group believes that Dunkelzahn was the avatar of the Great Dragon Spirit, their totem, and thinks that when Big D died, his spirit went back into the metaplanes to return again. They had been gaining some measure of prominence up until 61, but when a guy named Joshua Morningstar started rising through the ranks, a schism developed. The schism came to a head when Morningstar's faction, called the Church of the Dragon Reborn, began worshipping Ghostwalker as the rebirth of the dragon spirit that they believe was previously manifest in Dunkelzahn. Adding fuel to this fire was the fact that Ghostwalker soon endorsed the Church of the Dragon Reborn as legitimate, furthering his own ends. Now this next one gives me shivers, for all the wrong reasons. Let me back up. Just before Surge, there was a low-level humanist peon named Jeremiah Adams. Jeremiah spouted his racist hate speech at the wrong group of Sons of Sauron gangers, and they beat him senseless. Should have killed him, but the Humanist Polyclub sensed an opportunity. They gave everything they had to keep this guy alive, and denouncing the attack as a typical example of metahuman barbarism. Well, Jeremiah made a full recovery. Not because of the tender care of Humanist, but because he surged right there in the hospital. In addition to healing, his surge expression gave him 7 horns and a crown popping right out of his head. Now, Humanus was in a bind. They made a big deal about helping this guy, but now he's the very thing that they hate. So instead of tossing him, they claim that he is the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy. Now, I don't make a habit of telling others how to understand their holy texts, but when it comes to interpretations like this, I'll make an exception. These Seventh Seal guys were claiming that Adams was the Lamb of God, and according to their interpretation, the Lamb of God has 7 horns and ushers in a calamity on the rest of the world. In this instance, they believe that the falling star called Wormwood in the Book of Revelation is Halley's Comet, etc., etc., etc. I have lots to say about that, but I'll skip to the end by saying they're wrong for so many reasons. Still, there are a lot of dumb, hateful people out there, and it seems like a decent chunk of them ended up in Humanus or the Seventh Seal or both. They went on a campaign stomping metahumans and pitching their hate to whoever would listen, and those who were down on their luck and wanted a scapegoat found their salvation. Now, the last thing I'll say about this cult of the Seven Seals is about the irony of who was standing behind Jeremiah Adams during this time. A powerful and influential awakened individual named Simon White took an immediate interest in Adams. So much interest, in fact, that White took his not-at-all-small cult and joined them to the cult of the Seventh Seal almost immediately. Now, White followed a totem known as the Adversary. I have a lot to say about this mentor spirit, and almost none of it good. I know that it all seems romantic to follow the consummate rebel, and I am also aware of how hypocritical this might seem, but I don't care for many who bear the Adversary's influence. You know, this would make an interesting show later, talking about the differences between totems. Anyway, the bottom line is, these Seventh Seal guys presented themselves as Bible-thumping Christians, and they had a guy supporting them right there who has allegiance to the Bible's opposition figure. Now, listen, before you start on me about the adversary not being the Bible's Satan, blah blah blah, you're only half right. Most totems, even Raven, aren't pure forms of any belief system, but carve their essence from, or have influenced, the various cultures that revere them. Just because I've met at least one decent spider shaman and at least two okay mantis spirits doesn't mean that their totems have the best interest of the world at heart. Hear me, crows, the adversary is not modern Satanism. The adversary doesn't care about you at all. He'll turn on you as soon as you have no use to him anymore. And yes, there are some good people out there who have used the adversary's power to fight injustice and to do good, but you'll see, when the fighting is done, the adversary turns on its own. Back on topic. The next cult to spring up called itself the Atlantean Rebirth. They believe that they are the reincarnated versions of Fourth World Atlanteans who time-shifted their souls forward in time. These guys are lame. But they are powerful and connected, and word is that they essentially handpick these powerful, wealthy, or awakened people to be of supreme benefit to them, and then they use BTL chips to brainwash them. Every once in a while, I am reminded that not all rich and powerful people are wicked. Some of them are just stupid. Next up, the Church of the Undying Light springs up in Seattle. An early escapee from the Renraku arcology convinces a lot of people to give up all their stuff and do good works for everybody else. Seems like a great idea, but I remain skeptical. Especially since birdies continually tell me that, number one, Deus wasn't letting go of any connections that easily, and two, the money wasn't all going to charity, and that their founder was the daughter of a rich guy with mafia ties. Seems that the government eventually feels that giving grants to these guys is a good idea, but mark my words, crows, we're going to find out, just like the Universal Brotherhood, that these guys are not everything they seem to be. Lastly, there's this creepy business of the Bridging the Void cult. In August, they ritualistically murder 11 adults and 2 kids in New Orleans. A week later, in Vladivostok, 24 members of the cult go missing. The week after that, 6 freshly cut out metahuman tongues are drilled into signposts all around Portland, and 2 weeks after that, Lone Star goes on the trids telling everyone that these and at least 6 other mass murders worldwide are connected to these Bridging the Void fraggers. What does it say about me, little crows, that I am willing to face the wrath of Ares and the other megacorps just to bring you the truth? But when it comes to the truth behind these guys, I just can't bring myself to take the risk yet. The fact is, I'm still knee-deep in research on this myself, even 15 years later. I will say that these bridgers were performing ritual blood magic sacrifices on a scale that I haven't seen almost anywhere before. I have heard some rumors, though, about... Oh, never mind. It is my belief that they were trying to open up some sort of astral portal or bridge, but I should stop talking there before I say stuff I can only speculate about. Now, here is something that I know for a fact. You have now wasted an entirely good slot of time listening to the Anarchy and Podcasting Network. In closing, I want to give a hearty hello to our newest Patreon supporters, which receive monthly offerings of neo-anarchist street gear. Freshly included in this illustrious list of capable crow funders is David Vogt, David Lundy, Andrew Betts, Barriston, Phil Colby, Alex Santelli, Ivy, my chummer Joel Kramer, and Mark Hudson. Thank you all. Everything that you need to set up and maintain a neo-anarchist cell in your area, which at various levels now include new stickers every month, patches, dice bags, fake IDs of all sorts, contact sheets for Opti and his crew, and USB cred sticks, will be delivered to your safe house as we march bravely on. On another note, I'm not usually one to promote or commercialize products on the show. However, one of the tenets of principled neo-anarchism is non-coercive, non-monopolization of goods. To that end, those of you who want to spend your spare time playing games based on the shadow runs that we have been a part of might want to check Dexter's Dice and his awesome dice project. He is trying to kickstart his goods into existence, and with dice based on decking, rigging, magic, sociality, guns, and dragons, I am sure that every runner can find something perfect for you as you take a break from running the shadows to play games about running the shadows. So go find the awesome dice project on Kickstarter. I myself look forward to getting some of the pink social dice for Mr. Pink. Don't tell him. The music serving as the background to Audible Anarchy was written by the legend Marshall Parker and reimagined by Unanimium 88. This was the Neo-Anarchist Podcast, and I am your host, the quintessentially quirky quipper, questioning qualmless queries, quietly quilting his quest quota, and quenching his thirst with the quash of truth. Opti. Enjoy your freedom, but if you'd rather be a slave instead, there are a limitless supply of people ready and willing to help you achieve that goal.